Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 20th of January 1924, not for the first time, and probably not for the last, London's traffic. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. There's a threat of a railway strike. As I've mentioned before, this is a time of deflation and all sorts of people are having to take pay cuts. Pay in the railway industry, following grouping, is set by the government. But ASLEF, the drivers' union, then and now, has rejected its decision. So, to recap episodes past, in 1924, when it comes to the railways, the government controls fares, freight charges, wages and company profits. So much for capitalism. ASLEF, in case you are wondering, stands for the Associated Society of Locomotive Engineers and Firemen. A fireman in those days was the guy that kept the fire that heated the water to create the steam going. The phrase a locomotive engineer is one more associated with North America, and anyway, locomotives as such are rather thin on the ground these days. Also, aren't most societies by their nature associated? Mind you, the Society of Train Drivers would produce a rather awkward acronym, so probably best they kept it. With the prospect of a Labour or Labour-led government looming, attention has turned to Labour's leader, James Ramsay MacDonald. In a letter to The Times, John de Pennefather MP has reminded readers that at the outset of the First World War, MacDonald was happy to entertain and indeed publicise the idea that Britain had started it. Wars are dangerous. But in 1924, danger lurks in the most unlikely of places. This is from Monday the 14th of January, and is from a Mr. J.E. McCrae. It should be known that chlorate of potash voice lozenges, if carried in a pocket which has previously contained sweets or sugar in any form, may pick up some sugar dust, and on being struck or crushed in the pocket, will burst into a smouldering flame, difficult if not impossible to extinguish. I have seen this happen in the pocket of a choirman's cassock in a London church. Thursday's edition carried an advert for HMV. In those days, they made their money selling record players. These days, they don't seem to make any money at all. About the cheapest record player you could buy was £5. That's about an ounce of gold, which would be about £1,600 nowadays. But the pound was massively overvalued, so we can probably bring that down to about £800. All that for pretty ropey sound quality. Britain is still afflicted by stubbornly high unemployment. In a letter, Ernest Benn suggests some less well-known causes. Ernest Benn is an interesting character. He will at some point be the founder of the Society for Individual Freedom. Later on, that will give birth to the Libertarian Alliance, which for many years was Britain's leading libertarian organisation. This is from Monday the 14th. There are, in my view, four principal causes of unemployment, each of which is of far greater importance than any of those which are usually mentioned in public discussion. The first and most potent is the perverted mentality not only of the workers, but of the nation as a whole, which has almost ceased to think of the consumer. We talk of a job as if it were an end in itself. We think of it merely as a means of providing for the needs of the worker, and we seldom pause to consider the aim of the job or what is its real purpose. The performance of a piece of work by a worker is only of any service to him if others will also perform the work that he requires on terms that are agreeable to him. What he means, or at least what I think he means, is that sure, you can do a bad job and expect to reap the rewards, but if everyone else is doing a bad job, then you won't, because less is being produced. He goes on. If only we could all get back to the habit of thinking of the customer instead of ourselves, we should re-establish that fundamental basis of service which modern socialistic thought has well nigh destroyed. We Britons are not noted for our service culture. Or maybe we are. Bad service. But Ben suggests that this was not always the case. Also interesting that he blames socialist propaganda, despite the fact that Britain is yet to have a socialist government. This brings me to my second point, and I am fully aware of all its difficulties. The present unemployment crisis is, I believe, incapable of cure so long as we insist on clinging to all those restrictions and limitations with which, during the last 20 years, we have surrounded industrial and commercial activity. Now, what restrictions and limitations could he be talking about, I wonder? Limitation of production pushes up prices for the ever-diminishing few who can afford to pay, but it inflicts a cruel punishment on the many, whether consumers or workers, who are thus robbed either of comforts or work. The worker, having a piece of work to do, makes it last twice as long as is necessary, does appear to be securing to himself wages that he would not otherwise secure. But he overlooks the fact that under such conditions he is only called upon to perform work which must be done, and that he drives out of the market all that other work which his fellows would be glad to have on more reasonable terms. I have to confess I am struggling to make sense of that. Demarcation. Oh, that's better. Only certain workers can perform certain tasks, like only barristers being able to appear in court. Demarcation, another form of limitation, is a fruitful source of unemployment. There are 40 millions of us who day by day would be glad to have some little extra or some little comfort if some other fellow were willing to provide it on appropriate terms. But when that little trifle involves the employment not of one worker but of three or four, the comfort has to be abandoned. I don't think Ben is expressing himself particularly well here. What I think he means is that contemporary British industry has all sorts of regulations, agreements and practices that serve to reduce production and therefore increase prices. Consumers therefore have to pay more than they might otherwise have done, meaning that they have less to spend on other goods, the production of which might create employment for the unemployed. This is a very similar point to point one. The difference is that point one is a matter of attitude, while point two is a matter of government and trade union action. The third big cause of the unemployment trouble is to be found in what I may describe as the pretensions of the political parties. When an uninformed labourer is confronted at every street corner with a placard which says, "Vote for George and work for all," is it any wonder that he, in his innocence, should decide to leave it to George? We have reached a stage in which quite half of our people are under the totally false impression that it is the duty of somebody else to provide them with work or maintenance. However tempting this idea may be, it is high time that we exposed and abandoned it. The most powerful and wealthy of governments can do no more, under the most favourable conditions, than ease the hardships of some small minority, which may at any one time be in temporary difficulties. To claim more than this is to deceive. That deception has been too widely practised of late, and the false feeling of comfort derived from it is manufacturing unemployment wholesale. Or to put it another way, government responsibility crowds out personal responsibility. Of course, modern governments have done their darndest to prove Ben wrong. It is way more than a small minority who are on welfare. My fourth point, and here again I am on unpopular ground, is high taxation. Not with me, Ernest, not with me. Theoretically, money in the hands of the state can employ labour as well as money in private hands. But in practice, it is shown to be less effective. Private money circulates and turns over quickly. Public funds move slowly. And the consequent loss of time and turnover is largely paid by the workers who wait for the slower process. The taxation of any income depletes the wages fund and creates unemployment, but the heavy taxation of big incomes, popular as it may be, hits the labour market worst of all. I think he is way off here. The real problem with government is that it doesn't know what it is supposed to be doing. The market, through profit and loss, tells us what enterprises should exist and which should not. The market, through the price mechanism, tells us what needs there are to be satisfied. The speed at which money circulates is, if I've got this right, neither here nor there. It is on the men of great wealth that all communities rely to put in motion the machinery of trade and commerce. Whatever may be said or thought about great accumulations of riches, it cannot be denied that they possess the power to promote employment on a big and effective scale. Punitive taxation of such wealth, for which much theory can be advanced, has the undoubted practical effect of reducing the most important power on which we have hitherto relied for our industrial development. Or as someone once said, I never got a job from a poor person. There is nothing new, and certainly nothing popular, in any of these 4 points. Not one of them possesses any great vote-catching merit. You can say that again. But I am bold enough to affirm that they indicate the true causes of the bulk of our unemployment trouble. The general acceptance of these ideas would not suddenly or immediately put all our people into work, but if accepted, the trouble would quickly begin to diminish in size, and in very little time would assume such small proportion as to be capable of responding to governmental action, now not only futile, but actually dangerous. So how was unemployment solved? Was it ever solved? Some claim that nowadays we have huge hidden unemployment, masked by sickness benefits. To some extent, Margaret Thatcher followed Bend's agenda, breaking the power of the unions and ending some restrictions. Whisper it, but although she talked about tax cuts, taxes barely changed in her time. When she left office, or even when her successor John Major left office, unemployment was still much the same as in 1924. The government is drafting a bill to deal with London traffic. Although the details are yet to be published, The Times speculates that it will involve the establishment of a committee. They were great fans of committees in those days. The article outlines the nature of the problem. This is from Thursday, the 17th of January. The need of action in London is apparent to everyone who sees the traffic blocks. It would appear that the phrase traffic jam is yet to make it into the pages of the Times, which are a daily experience at the various congested points in the city, the West End, and such points as the Elephant and Castle, Vauxhall Cross, and Hammersmith Broadway. Official statistics are available to show how greatly traffic has increased in the last 20 years. The following figures are taken from traffic census returns made by the Scotland Yard authorities in 1904, 1912, and 1923. They represent the total wheeled traffic passing the particular observation points during a period from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on a given day. I don't propose to list them all. It would take too long. But here are the figures for Hyde Park Corner. Let's hope I'm not cherry-picking. In 1904, it was 29,286. 1912, 41,106, and in 1923, 56,039. That's a 91% increase. Actually, I am cherry-picking. The increase of the other points mentioned is about 50%, but that is still substantial. The increase has been chiefly in respect of motor cars, commercial motor vehicles, and motor omnibuses. The number of light cars passing Hyde Park Corner in 12 hours has increased from 20,095 in 1912 to 35,320 last year. That's a 75% increase, and bear in mind that's from 1912, not 1904, and there's been a war in between. Whereas 468 heavy motor vehicles passed Hyde Park Corner in 12 hours in 1912, the number in 1923 was 2,607. That's a 450% increase. Horse-drawn traffic, on the other hand, has substantially diminished. At Piccadilly Circus in 1912, 3,673 heavy carts passed in 12 hours. The corresponding number in the 1923 census was 861. In other words, a 75% decrease. What we are seeing here is a revolution, a mode of transport that has been dominant for millennia, being supplanted in a matter of years. You would have thought there would be a level of congestion in which less traffic moves, not more. it would appear that point is yet to be reached in 1923. I did try looking up modern-day figures. It is difficult to draw exact comparisons. Nowadays, the figures are for the whole day, not a 12-hour period, and there are three figures given for Hyde Park Corner, depending on the route. Adding those figures up, we get to 193,714, or almost four times, I should say this is for 2014, whatever, or almost four times the 1923 figure. Loath as I am to admit it, that implies that our road managers are doing something right. They also built a roundabout and a tunnel underneath it. Not everywhere in London is marred in jams. This is from Saturday the 19th. Strong comments on the excessive speed of motor omnibuses was made by Sir Chart Byron at Bow Street Police Court yesterday. There was a number of these cases before the court, and it was stated that in December last, a warning letter was sent from Scotland Yard to all omnibus companies to the effect that the speed at which omnibuses was being driven in Whitehall was excessive, and that unless it was reduced, action would be taken. The evidence showed that the omnibuses were timed over a measured distance in Whitehall, and in some cases a speed equal to as much as 25 miles an hour was recorded. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.